This is The Rounds Table.
Welcome back, Rounds Table listeners. My name's Katie Wiskar, and I'm your host from today. I'm a fellow in general internal medicine at the University of British Columbia, and I'm thrilled to be joined today by Dr. Kate Schultz, who is a newly minted general internist practicing in the Greater Vancouver area. So Kate, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Katie.
All right. So without further ado, we're going to dive into the article that you're covering today. And I admit that when I first read the article, I immediately thought of you because it covers a topic that's very close to both of our hearts. So why don't you tell me about the paper that you're going to be speaking about today?
That's right. I was very thrilled to read this paper. And so I want to discuss this trial, which examined the association between cardiorespiratory fitness in patients undergoing exercise treadmill testing and all-cause mortality. It was published in JAMA Open Network, October 2018, and the principal investigator was Man Sanger.
So I'm already interested because I love exercise, as do you. So tell me, what was the bottom line for this article?
Yeah, so this was a retrospective cohort study. Examined over 100,000 patients who were referred for symptom-limited exercise treadmill testing. And it found that all-cause mortality was inversely proportional to cardiorespiratory fitness, and specifically lowest for those elite performers.
So this sounds like very good news for exercise nuts like you and I,
who
love our triathlons and marathons and all kinds of things. So why don't you tell me a bit about sort of the broader context and why you think this article is important to discuss?
Mm-hmm. So there's a few important points in why I like this article. First of all, we all know that the improved cardiorespiratory fitness is linked to better health. But recently, there's actually been some contradictory evidence about intensive or excessive exercise. Some findings have suggested a U-shaped relationship between mortality and exercise duration and intensity, bringing into question whether it's necessarily true that the more exercise, the better.
I know I've read things like that about maybe an increased risk of atrial fibrillation or cardiac remodeling that's not stopped me from doing anything, but sort of made me question things a bit.
Exactly. I like to disregard them, but for the most part, but this study has really brought all of those kind of into question, and we'll talk about that a bit later. Secondly, though, I really like this study because as a general internist, I do a ton of exercise stress tests. And we all know an exercise stress test can tell us a lot of information other than just evidence suggesting obstructive coronary artery disease. In my training, I was always taught that the strongest prognostic variable is exercise duration or their functional classification. And so I really like this trial because it provides a good quality evidence to support that theory.
All right, I totally agree, and I'm intrigued to see sort of what we'll find as we unpack this trial. So let's get right into it. So tell me first, where did the study take place and what was its design?
Yeah, so it was a retrospective cohort study, and it looked at data collected over 24 years from a single center in the USA. So the patients they looked at were adult patients who were undergoing exercise stress testing, with the most common indication being evaluation for obstructive coronary artery disease.
Yeah, and that's a key point that you bring up here, and that this wasn't all comers. These were patients who were, for a clinical indication, whatever that was, referred for a treadmill test. Is that
exactly.
right?
Exactly. Okay. So on average, these were 50-year-old patients. They were a slightly higher proportion of males, and their mean BMI was actually overweight, so BMI of 28. About 15% of these patients had coronary artery disease already established. Mm-hmm. 50% had hypertension, 25% dyslipidemia, 10% diabetes. Interestingly, almost 50% of these patients were either current or prior smokers, which is higher than I would say I usually see in Vancouver.
Yeah, that's a biased West Coast population.
Exactly. And about one third of these patients were on aspirin and a quarter were on beta blockers or statins.
Okay, so a fairly high risk population, not unexpected given that they were referred for a clinical indication. And what was the intervention then, or the exposure that they looked at, I guess, given that this was an observational study?
Yeah, so the only thing they excluded were anyone who had to undergo a pharmacologic stress testing or had to be converted to pharmacologic stress testing because of the inability to reach 85% of their max heart rate. And this would make sense because the study is about exercise duration and not really whether the patient showed evidence of ischemia.
Okay, fair enough. So given this was an observational study, tell me about the exposure that they looked at.
Yeah, so they were examining cardiorespiratory fitness. So this was quantified as peak METs, or metabolic equivalents, that were achieved on a symptom-limited exercise stress test. And then they identified which percentile each patient fell into based on their cardiorespiratory fitness. So low, less than 25th percentile versus high or extremely high, elite, over 98th percentile.
Okay, so I think I understand the setup of what they were examining here. So then what was the primary outcome that they looked at?
Yeah, so primary outcome was all-cause mortality as determined by a death registry.
All right, that's pretty straightforward and pretty unbiased.
Yeah, I would just like to point out though, so obviously one would suspect there is a big difference in cardiovascular risk factors and medications between these fitness groups, right? So the low performers below that 25th percentile probably have more comorbidities and are on more medications than those elite performers. Mm-hmm. And so they did adjust for these differences in baseline characteristics, and they performed a regression model to construct a risk-adjusted association between mortality and cardiorespiratory fitness.
So that's some fancy statistics, and neither you nor I are statistics people, but I think that that's a really key point that you bring up, given that obviously there's going to be comorbidities and other things that influence the results here. So that's good to know that they controlled for that.
Exactly.
All right. I think we set the table. So tell me now, what did they actually find?
All right. So the primary finding was that out of the 100,000 patients, actually 13,000 died during the median follow-up of 8 years.
Wow.
And for an unadjusted survival, so that survival when they haven't controlled for all the comorbidities and medications, they found, as expected, the higher the heart cardiorespiratory fitness, the better you did, the less mortality you had. Okay. 24% of people in the low performance group, that below the 25th percentile, died versus 3% in the elite group. But what was very interesting is when they did that regression model, they found that all-cause mortality was associated with performance. Adjusted hazard ratios for low versus elite performers were estimated about 5. So that's a 5 times higher risk of death in the low performer group compared to the elite. And even when comparing performers that didn't differ that much, so below average performers versus above average performers, so that 25th to 50 percentile versus the 50 to 75th percentile, there was still an adjusted hazard ratio of 1.4. And that was statistically significant. The confidence interval didn't cross 1.
So some pretty major differences, and it seemed like in looking at their graphs, that relationship was maintained sort of across all of the percentiles, even some differences right up at the very extremes of exercise.
Mm-hmm. And I kind of want to put this into context because they actually examined the hazard ratios for common cardiovascular risk factors, such as smoking or diabetes. And they identified hazard ratios in the range of about 1.4. So this is suggesting that the cardiorespiratory fitness variable is actually comparable, if not greater, to the traditional risk factors that we all know and address.
Interesting. And I don't know about you, but for me, it's if I'm evaluating a patient for ACS who comes in with chest pain, it's not something that I necessarily ask them or put a lot of weight in the same way I would a history of diabetes or a family history of heart disease, those kinds of things. So that's really interesting to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so a lot to unpack there. Are there any particular points that you want to make about this study?
Yes, there are a few interesting points that I took away. So first of all, the adjusted mortality risk of reduced performance on exercise stress tests was comparable, if not greater, than traditional clinical risk factors that we examine every day. So I think I'm going to be paying more attention to that functional status, the cardiorespiratory fitness that my patients achieve on an exercise stress test as a prognostic variable that I can possibly modify. Second of all, I also found this article very interesting in that there is no upper limit of benefit with increased aerobic fitness. So elite performers did no worse than people with above average cardiorespiratory fitness. And we did see that they did much better than the lower performers.
Yeah, so I found that very interesting and reassuring, certainly as someone who exercises a lot. Not to say that I think that, given that this was an observational study, that it dispels what may be an increased risk of atrial fibrillation or cardiac remodeling. I don't think those questions are answered by this study, given its observational nature and given that it just looked at that very big picture endpoint of mortality. But I feel a little bit more reassured, you know, as I sign up for my next marathon or whatever.
Yeah. And I would like to point out that those previous studies, the ones that looked at the U-shaped relationship, like they were actually more looking at vigorous, intensive exercise, while this study was looking at how well you did on an exercise stress test. So while one would assume that doing intensive exercise with long duration will probably lead you to a better exercise stress test, they weren't necessarily looking at the same thing. So right. I don't know if we can totally ignore the previous studies because they are different.
No, that's a very good point. And the other thing that certainly caught my eye, I don't know if you found this as well, but I did wonder in reading this and in thinking of all the patients who I see who get exercise stress test, whether really cardiorespiratory fitness in this study is just acting as a marker of frailty. And what we're really seeing is that because that effect was, you know, particularly pronounced in older patients, what we're really seeing is just that less frail people who are, you know, in that upper few percentile for their age group have lower mortality. And that would not be surprising given all the, you know, risks we know that are associated with frailty. So I do wonder whether we're seeing exercise as maybe just sort of a surrogate for overall functional status.
Absolutely. I think it's acting as a surrogate for multiple things that affect our mortality. So I completely agree with that.
All right. Now, are there any significant limitations that you want to discuss?
Yeah, so it's the usual caveat about this study design in that it's retrospective cohort study. So conclusions drawn from this aren't going to be as robust as a prospective study or a randomized controlled trial. And we have to remember that this study only suggests an association, and there are several unmeasured factors that we can't adjust for. And as well, with regards to just generalizability, as you mentioned at the beginning, this was a population of patients with suspected coronary artery disease who were referred for exercise stress tests. So I don't think we can simply extrapolate these results to a different population or a low risk population and say that the more METs you achieve on an exercise stress test, the longer you'll live.
Right. So I can't go off and say to my husband that he should go run for 3 hours every night because that means he'll live longer.
Well, you can probably still say that, but not based on this study.
Got it. Noted. All right. So why don't we wrap up? Can you summarize the main learning point from the study?
So in this retrospective cohort study, metabolic equivalence calculated in the study as cardiorespiratory fitness is a strong modifiable indicator of long-term mortality. And we should consider this alongside traditional risk factors when calculating a patient's risk.
All right. And how is this going to change your practice as someone who's newly practicing as a general internist, seeing patients both in the hospital and in the outpatient clinic?
So honestly, I think I'll put more emphasis on those metabolic equivalents achieved during the exercise stress test my patients do. So when I review an exercise stress test with patients, I often find most are just so relieved and happy to hear that it was negative for ischemia. But I definitely think I'll be emphasizing their cardiorespiratory fitness on the test and using that to discuss risk factors and the fact that it's a large prognostic variable that we can potentially modify. And hopefully, you know, this will encourage some patients to work towards achieving higher levels of cardiorespiratory fitness.
Yeah, and obviously we can't draw the conclusion that, you know, by encouraging someone to be more fit, they will therefore live longer. But I certainly don't think that this study hurts in terms of ammunition to counsel our patients with regards to exercise and fitness through all stages of life.
Absolutely. I really do think this study just reaffirms what most of us already believe, that the patients generally have better prognosis the fitter they are, and specifically the further they're able to go on an exercise stress test.
Totally. All right. Well, thank you so much, Kate. That was fascinating. So let's move on to the article that I chose to talk about this week. So I'm talking today about the VITAL trial. So this was two papers actually published in the New England Journal of Medicine in November of 2018 about vitamin D supplementation and omega-3 fatty acids and the prevention of cancer and cardiovascular disease. So similar to last time I presented the Esprit trial, where we had three papers covered in one short podcast, we're talking about two different papers this time, sort of published as sister articles in NEJM. And the first author here was Joanne Manson.
So what's the bottom line of these articles, Katie?
Okay, so the bottom line here is that in this large nationwide double-blinded placebo-controlled RCT of over 25,000 patients, supplementation with omega-3 fatty acids or vitamin D in a primary prevention cohort did not lead to a statistically significant reduction in the incidence of invasive cancer or of major cardiovascular disease.
Very interesting. Given how many times patients ask me about vitamin D and omega-3s for their health. So why did you choose these articles?
Well, I think that's the point exactly. So maybe it's a particular West Coast thing, but I feel like everybody and their dog are on various supplementations for all kinds of things. And the supplement industry, as we know, is a multi-billion dollar industry. But despite that, there's often not a lot of good evidence supporting the scientific claims for many of these products. So in this study, they actually looked at two sort of common supplementations. So vitamin D, we know, is good for bone health and osteoporosis, and that is not being debated. But there has been some observational data and sort of basic science data suggesting a possible benefit in terms of both cardiovascular disease and cancer, particularly in patients living in more northern climates. So Canada, who get less vitamin D from sunlight. However, there is no good randomized controlled data addressing that subject. Likewise, in omega-3 fatty acids, there is a very sort of mixed bag at present of studies looking at primary or secondary prevention and the effects on, again, cancer and cardiovascular disease. And there's actually recommendations included in both the AHA and the CCS guidelines for omega-3 fatty acids in patients with coronary disease and heart failure, respectively, though that's not based on very good evidence. So this trial really sought to kind of answer those questions in a primary prevention population.
Yeah, that sounds great. I definitely think these kind of trials looking at preventative medicine are great to see because there's such little focus on preventative medicine in our healthcare system. And I'm very excited to be covering this because I think, as you mentioned, anytime this is in the media, patients will be asking you or talking about it. So knowing the evidence behind it is great. So let's get into things. So what were the methods of this trial?
All right, so this was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial. So theoretically, the best kind of evidence. And it was sponsored by the National Institute of Health. Industry, I will say, did donate the vitamin D and omega-3 supplements, respectively, but had no other role in the trial. And it was a 2x2 factorial design. So kind of a clever little design that I'm sure you've seen before. When you're doing a trial of such large magnitude where there's so much organizational effort, it kind of makes sense to kill two birds with one stone if you can. So they looked at both vitamin D versus placebo as well as omega-3 fatty acids versus placebo.
Great. So who are the patients that they studied?
So the inclusion criteria for this was pretty broad. They looked at adults in the US, men over the age of 50 and women over the age of 55, without a history of cancers, excluding non-melanoma skin cancers, or cardiovascular disease. Really, that was about it. There was a few specific exclusions. So they excluded anyone with renal failure, cirrhosis, hypercalcemia, granulomatous diseases, things like that, where you can reason out that vitamin D supplementation would maybe be harmful. And they actually recruited participants through mailed information sheets, as well as by placing ads in lifestyle magazines. So kind of an interesting recruitment model. But given that this was all sort of outpatient and questionnaire-based, sort of made sense.
Interesting. And what interventions were they examining?
So as we said there, this was a 2x2 design. So they looked at both vitamin D versus placebo. And for that arm, one group got vitamin D3 at a dose of 2,000 international units a day. And the other group got a matched placebo. And then omega-3 fatty acids versus placebo. And there it was 1 gram per day of omega-3 fatty acids.
And then the outcome they looked at?
So their primary outcome, so they had two primary outcomes, kind of dual outcomes. So we end up with sort of four questions that we're answering if you think about the vitamin D group for each of the two dual primary outcomes. So their first was invasive cancer of any kind. And this was basically any new cancer diagnosis and had to be confirmed with cytological or histological findings. And the other one was a major cardiovascular event. And they defined that as an MI, stroke, or death from cardiovascular causes. There were also a few secondary outcomes that they looked at, of course. So they, for the cancer endpoint, they broke down several individual cancers, as well as looked at cancer death. And for cardiovascular disease, they looked at the individual components of the primary outcome again, as well as coronary revascularization.
All right, so a group of patients without cardiovascular disease who are either randomized to omega-3s or vitamin D with the outcome of either cancer or cardiovascular disease.
Just to clarify, so they were randomized to vitamin D or placebo, and then omega-3s and placebo. So you could have a patient getting both active treatments, so vitamin D and omega-3s, or likewise, you could have a patient getting double placebo in that 2x2 table.
Right. So there are four different options.
Yes. And then just in terms of how they actually assess their outcomes, so they measured this by questionnaires that they sent out to the patients at 6 months, a year, and then annually. So it was all self-reported, but to the researchers, credit, because this is quite the undertaking, anyone who reported an event then had their medical records assessed by one of the study investigators to verify the accuracy of that event. And they followed these people for an average of just over 5 years.
Okay, so tell me a little bit more about these patients. Were these patients that we'd see in the GIM clinic?
Well, I think so, though they may actually be a bit too healthy to be in a GIM clinic. So the population they looked at were just over 25,000 adults with a mean age of 67 that were fairly well balanced for comorbidities, but overall quite healthy. It was a mostly Caucasian population, but there was a reasonable balance of other ethnicities as well. And as I said, these were patients free from cardiovascular disease as well as from any history of cancer.
All right, so it does sound like a pretty healthy population. What were the main findings of this study?
All right, so as I say, we're going to talk about sort of four different primary outcomes, given that we had two dual primary